Help me welcome our speaker tonight, Rob R. from the Bethlehem Group.
Nice. Good evening. My name is Rob, and I am an alcoholic. Thanks for having me out. I appreciate Lauren asking me to come here. This is the first time I've ever been at this meeting, and it's a cool setting. It's an awesome setting out here, so you guys must really love the summertime. The Bethlehem Group is my home group. I'm the chairperson for this year. I took that commitment. It's Mondays and Friday nights from 8 o'clock to 9 p.m. We're actually having a picnic on Sunday, August 11th, and Lauren's the speaker at 5 o'clock, but I think the picnic starts around 2 at Dimmock Park. So if anybody wants to come up, that would be awesome to see you guys. I haven't spoken much in a while, and I haven't spoken in a setting like this in a long time. And I was talking to some people before the meeting, and I got to a point where I don't think too much about what I'm going to say. Maybe I'll try to piece together some bits and pieces, but really, the only qualification I have for being here is that Lauren asked me, and I'm sober today, and my sobriety date is December 9th, 2013. And I often hear people say they're not grateful enough for their sobriety, and I can feel that way at times too, and then there's other times I'm overwhelmed with gratitude for where I'm at today. I also love the set-aside prayer because there was a Shore meeting I went to and they would read that. And it was said in the meeting the other night that my solutions are sometimes worse than my problems. And I could really relate to that because I couldn't think myself out of a paper bag. And even today, if I'm not spiritually set and pause, I can react. And I can then find out about 10 minutes down the road that I shouldn't have reacted to that person because they might have been in a worse position than me. And maybe I should have been sober and just kind of chilled out and realized that I need to accept things. So with that, I'll tell you a little bit about what it was like. I grew up in central New Jersey. I grew up in Edison, New Jersey. My father left at 10 o'clock, when I was 10 years old. And my story is no different than a lot of people's. Abandonment is a big thing that affected me, and I know that when I look back, led me down many paths to try to just feel like one of. So he left at 10 years old. I was one of the only families that was divorced in my neighborhood. I took that kind of hard. I had isms from the get. If there was Atari Anonymous back then, I probably burned up some power packs and played video games often before I found the booze. And what ended up happening was my mom did her best. My mom was often very depressed, and she was working two jobs and trying to provide for me and my sister. But the selfishness in me was like, why don't I have everything? Why don't I have the good cereal? Why don't I have all the things that my friends have? Why don't I have parents that come to my baseball games? And that's where my head was at. It was never that she's working hard and doing the best that she can with what she's been given. And what ends up happening is she meets a man when I was about 15 years old. And to this point, you know, I had just been sharing beers. We were stealing cans of beer and walking around the neighborhood. You know, it was nothing crazy at that point. But at 15 years old, she got remarried. And I had a choice to move with my father down in South Jersey, or I could move with my mom and my stepfather. And I chose to move with my father, and there's a reason for that. It's because I knew that I could get away with whatever I wanted. Because he was never around, and he kind of had run away from the family, and I knew that I could do whatever I wanted. And the house where my mom was, I used as an excuse that we argued all the time to not want to go live there, where I would have had a warm cooked meal by my stepfather every single night. I would have had any clothes and housing. Anything that I needed would have been there. And instead, I chose to live in a trailer with an alcoholic grandfather that I watched, you know, get ripped, born drunk every single day. And I was okay with it because I thought, this is what I can do, you know, this is the way it is. But what happened when I was 15 that summer, I was on a baseball team and we went to an Eastern Regional in New Hampshire, and I was going to be moving in with new friends a couple weeks later. And I had a panic attack basically up there at the Regionals, and I developed irritable bowel syndrome. And it paralyzed me for 24 years. The next 24 years of my life were paralyzed by that syndrome. And what happened was that led me down to my alcoholism because I ended up getting homeschooled for a year. And so I told all the friends that I was local with that I went to the other school for 2 years. And I told all the people down here, you know, that I went vice versa. Because I was filled with guilt, shame, remorse my entire life. I didn't have a God when I walked into this program. I don't know if I hated God, but I thought, why did you make me this way? Why did I not get all the good stuff? Why did I not get the playbook? Why did I not, you know, why am I not taller, more athletic, be able to talk to the girls? All that, I used to be like, God, why did you do that? And then with that, with the guilt, shame, and remorse, I thought I was no good to a God, so why bother? And that's how I ended up walking into these rooms. But at 15, after being homeschooled for a year, I really felt weird. I felt strange. I couldn't even get through a school year. I didn't get to play any sports, which was about the only thing that made me feel whole. And I eventually found my way somehow, some way, I found my way back into school. And I finished up high school at this school, but I decided to take a hostage. I found a girl that I really liked as a friend. We were both not dating anybody. She got pregnant, senior year. And I said, you know what, if I have a family, everything's going to be good. Because I didn't think anybody would ever want to marry me, so now I've got a built-in family. And I ended up having 3 children with her by the time I was 24 years old. So if you talk about isolation and separation, all the friends that I had grown up with pushed us away because they didn't know how to handle that situation either. And all through this time, my alcoholism started to progress. And it got to the point where I would create fights and arguments in the house in order to be able to slam the door, get in the car. I controlled everything. I controlled her. I controlled the money. I was the only disciplinarian. So I used to use that later on, which I might touch on, about how basically she let him get away with anything. But I would say, hey, you can't do this. You can't do that. But really, it was all about control for me. Income tax would come in, and I would go in and I would steal it out of her purse. But I wouldn't think that was stealing at that time because I was the one that filed it usually, and I was the one that worked more than she did. And I had all those excuses, and those are the behaviors that I had lived with, you know, through my marriage and that she had to put up with. So what ends up happening is I guess I was about 27 years old, and I had all the isms, but the alcoholism really started to come in to play. I started playing softball. They had a bartender that worked Tuesdays and Thursdays, and I was after the games. I was going in there. He had my beer ready. I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. I'd love their wings, and I would drink and eat wings every Tuesdays and Thursdays. Turns out he also worked Saturdays, so I should go in on Saturday, too. This is my guy. And 3 days a week turned into 7 days a week relatively quickly, probably within the next couple of months. So I would use any excuse to go and to leave. And within 4 years, I was knocking on my in-law's house, dropping off my family, because I couldn't pay the rent again, because we would move pretty much once or twice a year the entire time I was with them. And my oldest was 12, my son was 9, and my youngest was 7. And so when I knocked on the door, my father-in-law answered, and I said, can they please stay here? You know, we're going to lose our place. And can I stay too? And he looked at me and said, they can absolutely stay here, and you can't. It's the right thing to do, you know? It was the right thing to do. I look back on that, and I just say to myself, if I'm ever put in that position, how will it be, you know? But I don't try to project that, and I hope I never have to worry about that. But I think about that day. I can remember it very vividly, knocking on that door with whatever we could carry and leaving them there. The man eventually built an addition onto his house so that he could house my family. And my kids still live there today. And I was able to do amends later on and thank him for that and ask what I could do to repay that debt. Because my kids had somewhere to be and they weren't on the street. And it gave them a chance to have some normalcy. So I dropped them off. And my job takes me to South Jersey. I use that as an excuse. I'm running a retail shop. And I'd rather not fight, so I don't answer phone calls. So it's better to go dark and not talk to them. I don't want to talk to her and fight. I'm ashamed of who I am as a father, as a human being. It's not that I don't want to be around my kids, but I'm ashamed of who I've become. And for that, I become an absentee father for the next 8 years of my life. And you're talking about a 12-year-old, 9-year-old, and 7-year-old. And they have basically no father in their life for about 8 years, other than when I was coaching football. And I would use that to my advantage, too, because I'd try to look cool because I was coaching. And even though I loved the kids, it was a lot of a facade in the sense that I meant well, but my actions very often couldn't back it up, and I was very unreliable about how often I would show up at practice. Because if I went to the bar, I wasn't showing up at practice. Because all of a sudden, I start feeling better because I'm putting alcohol into my system, and everything else is off because, quite frankly, I need it, and I need it now, and I need it because I can't feel life. And I don't want to feel life because life's terrible. And it's terrible because I don't have a track record of being able to put one foot in front of the other and ever being reliable. I have all the best intentions, and I talk about the big picture, and when one thing falls short, I'm off to the races. And it's an everyday occurrence. So I'm boozing every night. I'm at that retail store for, since we're being recorded, I'm trying to keep it real general here. So we're at this retail store, and I'm basically, I'm stealing again, right? I'm stealing. I'm taking care of the customers. The customers are loving life. I'm treating them well. Somehow I increased in sales and all these other things. But I'm doing some really shady stuff so that I can drink every night and I can try and buy friends at the bar. Because I have nobody in my life that's known me that wants to be near me. Because I always say the worst things, the most inappropriate things, even trying to be funny. So I'm never invited anywhere. So I'm buying folks at the bar by buying drinks. So I end up getting caught for it. They come in, they do a surprise audit, and they tell me that I have two options. I can go see the prosecutor or I could resign. So I was very honorable and I resigned because I didn't want to go to jail. And it's only because there were some people looking out for me that they even gave me that option, you know? So what happens is that's bottom, right? You know, I'm going to get better. I'm going to do something that's going to be worthwhile. And so I decide I want to go back to school and I want to teach and I want to coach. I do love sports. I do love coaching kids. So the only way I can go back to school is if I become a bartender. So that's what I did. So I got a job working at the Chili's, making like $50 a shift, working as a waiter. And I've got three children at home that are in their teens. So I can't send them money. I don't have any money. And every money that I'm making is going into my belly. That's the way it was. Nothing else mattered. Budgets didn't matter. Rent checks didn't matter. Matter of fact, I would write checks so that then I could go bounce them. I could hit the ATM before it cleared. So the intention was to do this, but then I needed this, so I had to go take that money right out. And so I'm painting a picture, hopefully, that many of you guys may know, is that this is a vicious cycle that just goes on and on and on, that I just keep doing these things. And it gets to the point where it's important for me to share that it doesn't matter. Your circumstances matter less to me nowadays than ever before. It's how you feel and what it's doing in your life. My story is no better than anybody else's. It's just a little different. And if I say one thing that can help somebody, maybe it's because they relate to something I do. And the same goes for you. There's going to be people in here that need your help that are going to relate just like that. So what ends up happening is I get a job in Trenton. I'm working at these two bars. And I'm doing a lot of crazy stuff that I'm drinking all hours of the night. And I'm living with three girls, all friends, all bartenders. We're not going to bed until 5, 6 o'clock in the morning. Blasting music. We have his house right around the corner. And I'm getting so messed up that there's times that I'm pulling into, like, cul-de-sacs and I'm sleeping on the floor in the back seat hoping people aren't going to walk out to their car in the morning and see me passed out and call the cops. So, like, I'm tucked down in the wheel well like I used to do as a little kid, you know? And that was most nights, almost every night. I didn't know where it was going to end up. I didn't know who I was going to end up with, if I was going to be in the inner city, if I was going to be out in the rich area. I didn't know, but I used whatever I had in order to get there. So what ends up happening is through a, I don't know, it's not luck, I guess, just whatever happens, I get a job up in New York City that I landed on a whim, and it was a great job. It was a great job, and it made a lot of people proud of me and excited because I got to meet people that they like got a kick out of the fact that I got a chance to work with on a daily basis. And I made more money than I ever made before. And I blew more money than I ever made before. So the reason I share that is not because, oh, that's great, you know, and there might be one person out there that says, yeah, well, if I made that, I wouldn't blow it. And okay, you can think that way. All I know is what I know about me is there's no amount of money that I wouldn't have blown through to get what I needed and to spend the way I did. I had no respect for it. I had no respect for anybody else. I wanted to respect them, but I couldn't do it. All I needed was to drink. Look at me, you know, I made it, and it was all a fraud. I was a big fake. I was a get-over guy. I just wanted to look special, and I wanted people to look up to me and be like, wow, look at that guy. He's got it all together. And it was all fake, and it would always crumble on me. It would always crumble on me. So what ends up happening is, it's hard to share this, but my ex-wife, in 2011, I'd been out of the house since like 03. And in 2011, like I kept, you know, when I'd be hurting real bad, I would email her or text her and tell her to come over and like console me and all this, you know, and I was doing that whole game. And in 2011, I got shoulder surgery. And she was nice enough to drive me to my surgery and drive me home from my surgery. And the next day, while the nerve block was still on and everything else they give you, I needed to get out to the bar. And I drove with one arm out to the bar. And it flipped a switch with her and never turned back. That was the moment, and I don't forget that either. And I know what I had done to her for so many years and how I treated her for so many years. But that moment when I just used her for that moment because I couldn't handle it any other way started this huge bottom for the next couple of years. The following year, I moved close to the kids about a mile away, and I still never saw them. My daughter wanted to get kittens, so I thought, well, now she'll have a reason to come over to the house. I didn't take care of them. They took over the house. Fleas, litter box, everything. I had fleas biting me for the next year. And I bombed the house. I dipped the cats. And my buddy always reminds me. He says, you know what? The fleas are waiting for you. And as disgusting as it is, he's right. They were on my ankles. They were on my clothes. It was craziness. I had little t-shirts over those windows of this house that were my, those were my drapes. I had a laundry basket upside down. I mean, I didn't need it. I didn't wash the clothes. I mean, it was so rare. I basically went out and bought new clothes every weekend. And then I destroyed them. And then I went out and bought. So every other week when I got paid, I was out buying like a tracksuit or something just to be a bum and not have to wear a suit. And I would wear my suits and they had holes in them. I had holes in my shoes. When it rained, I would step into a puddle and then my feet would stink and the whole nine. I mean, this is where I was. I was existing, and I wasn't taking care of anything. So this laundry basket's flipped upside down. The TV's on top of it. I don't have cable because I don't pay my bills. The heat's on low because I bounce checks with every oil company in the area. So when it gets cold, I'm just praying that the pipes don't freeze and then burst. And I'm watching The Matrix, Gladiator, and The Perfect Storm, I think, every night of the week, over and over again. I didn't watch comedies back then. Because I was in such a dark place, I felt like I didn't want to laugh. So like The Wedding Crashers, all that stuff, I came into when I got into sobriety, man. I couldn't watch this stuff. I only had to watch stuff that was like, I wanted to either be the man or just be down. And so what's going on is like, the cats go to a farm. The fleas were like still there, man. They was really crazy. You just couldn't get rid of these things, man. They would come to my office with me in Manhattan. Like, no kidding. It's crazy. And I would sleep on the rest area in Jersey because I didn't want him to bite me at night, even if I wasn't drunk, which was rare. So all this is happening, and the house is a disaster. It's like a hoarder's nightmare. Superstorm Sandy came in and hit, and it hit us pretty hard. I was without power for 14 to 15 days. I had a marine cooler that usually had beer to my softball games in the back of my Impala. It took the entire back seat. The guys remind me that that might have been a problem back then. And it had green fungus in there, you know, because I never threw it out. I mean, this is I ate out when I ate out. Or I ate in my bedroom, and there was cardboard boxes from pizza all over the floor. And I got to a point where I contemplated suicide. And when I say contemplated, I pictured myself hanging from my belt from that banister. And this is in 2012. And I said to myself, you know, like, my kids are going to find out that their dad committed suicide. And there are no words to really describe. There's words I don't try to use anymore. Of what that house looked like, that they would have found me in. And that would have been etched in their mind, you know? And I thought about the subway. You know, I could maybe slip, make it look like an accident. And with that, I called employee assistance. My company had an employee assistance program, and I'm forever grateful for that, because what ends up happening is I call and I say, I believe I have a problem with alcohol and drugs. I'm very depressed. I've thought about suicide. And I need help. I couldn't get an appointment with the therapist for a few months. I called after like the New Year's, because you got to understand something. All the holidays I spent alone crying in my bed, because the bars weren't open most of the time. And I had boozed. If I saw the kids, it was for 2 seconds in the morning to give them maybe like a $5 gift card and a card and say that I saw them, and they were gone, because I didn't want to, I just couldn't be seen. I didn't want to be with them because I couldn't provide. So April 6, 2013 is when I got this appointment with this counselor. She was in Princeton. And she called me 2 days ago out of the blue. And I go to this appointment, and let's just put it this way. Two nights before Thursday night, I was getting messed up. My direct deposit went in on Friday. I went and wasted all but $200. I owed somebody $120. So I went and paid that guy $120, and I was left with $80 for the next 2 weeks. And I walked into that bar where my good buddy was working Tuesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays, and every other Friday. And I ran a tab there every 2 weeks, and he pulled his tab out, and he says, "You gonna pay this?" And I just looked at him, and he goes, shook his head, look of disgust. But it was the first time I was really disgusted with myself, because normally I would have been like, "Come on, man, you know I'm good for it, like I'm gonna get you." But this time was different. This time, maybe it was because I had taken the steps to make that appointment, this time it was different, and I said, "No, I can't." And I drank that beer he had put out for me, and I put it down, and I walked out of there. And I'm really glad I did, because it was about 10 o'clock at night, the night before a 10:30 a.m. appointment. And if I would have kept going or ran to the right people that could have hooked me up and kept me going, I'm probably not standing here today. And maybe you guys would be grateful for that. But what ends up happening is I wake up, and I go to this therapist. It's drizzling. It's in Princeton on Nassau Street, the main drag there. She calls me and says, "Are you coming?" Because many people blow off therapy appointments. I don't know if you guys can relate to that, but many people want the help, but then they're all better. Like, I'm good. I want help, but I'm not going to go that far. And, she goes, I go, "Yeah, I'm sitting out on the bench," because this is how I talked about everybody to everything, man. It was just a chore to even like get up in the morning. "I'm sitting on the bench like you told me, and it's raining on me." And she goes, "There's benches inside the building outside of my office." My brains were scrambling. I had no clue. And I go in and I dumped on her what I shared with you guys. And she looked at me and said, "I believe you're an addict and an alcoholic. And I think you need to go to an AA meeting before I see you again. And I'm going to see you on Monday." This was Saturday. There was an honesty that happened in that 45 minutes. I never told anybody the things that I had done Outside of things that most people would be okay with, I never told anybody the other things. And I shared it all with her. And I was mush because I dumped it. And I went to a meeting that night. But before I went to that meeting, I love wings, right? I told you that. You probably could tell. That's why I wear suspenders. It's not for the look. It's out of necessity. So I stop for wings, and a girl pops a beer for me as I walk in. And I say, no, 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 no. And thank God I didn't drink it that day. Because had I not, I wouldn't be at that meeting that night, my first ever AA meeting on April 6, 2013, not my sobriety date. But I went to that meeting, don't remember much of it. Remember a few of the people that were there. People now tell me they were there. They remember me. And I didn't drink that night. And I texted a buddy that had invited me to church at softball. And I texted him, I'm like, what time is it tomorrow? And I showed up there too. Because I woke up not hungover. And a woman that I used to coach with her husband looked at me as I walked in. She goes, what are you doing here? And I said, that's a good question. I said, my buddy invited me. I went to this little study, which I was really appreciative of, because the regular church thing was not ever hitting me. So, like, I went to this little study thing they did, and they related it to real life, and it woke me up a little bit. I was like, oh, wow, I can get that. Like, that makes sense. It's real life. It's kind of like what we do here, you know? We talk about situations. And when I left, she came up to me and gave me a hug and says, you made my day from being here. She hadn't seen me in 7-8 years, and most people in that congregation knew exactly what I'd been doing and where I'd been. And I was nowhere around my family. And people definitely looked down on me, as they should. It was a bad show that I was doing to my family, right? But I got this love that's all I've ever been looking for. And if I had to boil it down, I'm always looking to be loved and be part of and to be part of a fellowship. And I just never thought I was good enough. And why am I not good enough? So I go to that meeting. I go to that service with my buddy. I go to another meeting at Ryder College. There's one dude there. And I'm like, this is weird. This is really weird. But we read the big book, and I left. And I'm like, I need another meeting because that was just a little different for me. But thank God he was there carrying the message, you know? And so I went to another meeting, and then I walked to a church about 2 miles from my office in down by Wall Street, which was cool. It was like a dingy old basement, so it was like what you would think AA would be, right? And when I went to see my therapist, she goes, did you go to a meeting? I said, I've been to 4. And you should have seen her eyes, like she was shocked. And she later told me, because I asked her, why did you need to see me on Monday? And she said to me, I didn't know if you could go any longer without drinking and not kill yourself. That's the truth. And me and her built a relationship over 3 years where I could ask those questions and she knew I could handle the real answers. And that's the truth. So what I will say is, if you're sitting here and you don't like AA anymore and you're really bored, human beings in general are self-centered to the extreme. As babies we come out, we're crying for our food. We're crying for our attention. It is the way it is. And if you're new, I hope you realize there's people here that I was told have been waiting for you. They're here to help you. And that's what I started to experience as I started to go to meetings after meetings after meetings. And I did a lot wrong. I went to about 300 meetings in the next 6 months. And I got a sponsor by name only. And I was going to the bar every single night, drinking water, saying I was different. And I was going to be inducted into the Miller Lite Hall of Fame in 5 years when I was eligible. It's going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer. And I believed it. And so what ends up happening is, you know, I'm going to these meetings. I'm getting harassment charges at the bank because I'm bouncing checks and they're shutting down my ATM card and I'm stuck in the city and I'm walking from Penn Station to Soho and I'm mad and I'm sitting there and I'm pouting. And I didn't even know they called the cops, but they called the cops because I finally left before they got there, but I didn't even know they were coming. This is how I live my life. And what ends up happening is I had a buddy, good friend of mine. We drank a lot together. We played a lot of softball together. Funny guy, great charisma. Somebody that just always lit me up, you know? And he did some things that I won't need to share about, but he did some things and the heat was on at home, and his girlfriend at the time is a mutual friend. And he knew I was getting sober, and he asked me to come to meetings. So we did. For 90 days, he didn't drink. I walked into the bar on a Friday night, because I was going every night, and he was out of his mind, didn't even notice me, and it rocked me. Because I hadn't done any kind of work in here other than the fellowship, which I love and is important, but there was more for me that I needed to do. And the next morning, I went to my morning meeting at 7 a.m., we played softball, and I told him we were drinking, and when he tried to talk me out of it, I said, "You were out there last night?" And we went and drank. I was just short of 6 months. Felt like an idiot. Came back on Monday, raised my hand, because you know I was regurgitating all the words. I was good at that, because I was really into it, and I was fired up, and I could say the words, but I wasn't feeling the words. I couldn't transmit it, because they weren't really in here. I could just say them and sound smart. Sound good, I guess. So I come back in, and after 3 weeks, I'm sorry I missed your business meeting, because after a business meeting, I got really mad, and I used that as an excuse to go back out again. And I went back out for about 3 weeks, 5 weeks, I don't know what it was, but I went out, and on December 8th, 2013, I went to the Jet Raider game, and I'm a Jets fan, and it's okay. And I was the kind of Jets fan that used to get so drunk before the game. I would go in before a Miami game, and I would pass out naked in the stall because I was sweating, because I was so sick, and I was throwing up and doing everything else. And I came 2-3 hours later with somebody hearing them in the urinals saying, "Man, I can't believe we lost again," you know, on a kick return. And I was passed out for 3 hours, and I had bruises on my knees from being passed out for 3 hours for like 3 weeks. That's the kind of fun that I was when I went to football games. And anything else. So what happens is I go to that Jet Raider game. I knew there were people there. I knew I was going to drink. I knew I needed this program. I didn't know that I wanted it. I thought I did, but I didn't know for sure. So I dipped into a few meetings. I wasn't raising my hand saying I was coming back again because I knew that I was drinking on that Sunday. And I did. And I fired my half a can that was left into a dumpster on the way into the stadium. I didn't drink in the stadium. My phone went dead, thank God. And I slept on the way home. I called out of my office the next morning, and on December 9th, 2013, I went to an AA meeting at noon, and I raised my hand, and I said, "I'm coming back." And I asked for a meeting list, and I got numbers of the guys. And a guy with a lot of time, not that I'm giving him a hard time, because it's cool, he says, "I knew you'd go out." And all I could say at that time, because I was really broken, was, "Well, thanks. I'm glad you knew." The point of that story isn't to bash in. It's to say it doesn't matter what other people say or do to you. It's up to you if you're going to pick up a drink or not. We can all paint a sad story and give somebody a hard time and say, "Woe is me. Poor me, poor me another." But when I was ready at that moment, I was humbled enough for some reason at that moment not to get angry and to hear this message. And about a week later, I reached out to a guy who believed in working the steps quickly. So I always put a disclaimer out there. Get a sponsor and do the steps the way that they know to take you through them. That's my opinion, just based on what my experience is. This guy believed in working quickly. He says, "I need to get you some relief, and the relief's going to be in the steps of the big books of Alcoholics Anonymous." And when I asked him if he'd work with me, he said, "Yeah, let's go." And we met at the diner 3-4 times a week. We met different places, and I started doing the work. It's the first time I ever got past step 3, because I definitely was one of those guys that pushed off the dreaded fourth step. Right? I didn't want to do it. I looked at these steps like they were Mount Everest. I didn't think I could do it. I failed at everything I ever tried to do that was good for me. So how is this going to be any different? But he said, my job is to get your hands in God's. He didn't go crazy. That's what he said. And that's what we did. So we start doing the steps. I remember doing the fifth step with him. He flips over the diner mat. He's got the placemat. He flips it over. He goes, you don't mind if I take some notes, do you? And I'm like, sure. He's like, I'm going to start making a list of amends and some of your defects of character. And I'm like, okay, all right, sure. So he's writing some things down. You know, there's a lot of anger in there. And there's some immediate amends, obviously, with kids and with an ex-wife and some other things. And I love Mike. You know, because what ended up happening was at the end of the 3 weeks that it took us to work through those steps for the first time in my life to get through the 12 of actually working them and have a working knowledge, three things happened. First, I'll say this, at the fifth step, I did feel my first spiritual experience. Something like a weight was lifted when I shared it. That was something that did happen to me. There was something that came with me, and then I went and got quiet for an hour. And then I continued on with 6 and 7, and I was like, man, we're cooking. 5, 6, and 7? Like, whoa, I could do this. And there's nothing wrong with that, because the book says it just like that. Now we need to do more, you know? And so we're cooking with that. But when I got through those 12 steps, I had still had that obsession to drink and use all the way until I had that working knowledge of the 12 steps at Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I had that and I read through that, my obsession to drink and to use was lifted, and so was my irritable bowel syndrome. 24 years. Paralyzing me from going on trips, chaperoning kids' events, even when I could show up or really was going to try and show up, there was no chance because I didn't want to be embarrassed by something that shamed me and led me to my further addictive natures gone. And what that did for me, it was a miracle. And it gave me a faith in a higher power that I have today and I continue to try and grow with. And that's my story. I can't tell somebody else's story about that. But what is it like today? I can still be crazy. I did not use any sign language on the way here, so I hope that nobody was driving around me on 476 or not. I'm trying really hard not to, but I'll tell you, I was sharing with somebody, the Pennsylvania drivers, I'm a Jersey guy still at heart, even though I love Bethlehem. Man, they're animals out here, I'm telling you. And then they tell me they all moved from Jersey. So I'm like, all right, well, that makes sense. So what it's like today is I show up at work. I was blessed with a new job. I've been out of work. My cash and prizes, in the sense of the material stuff, hasn't evolved quite yet. Okay? No big deal. That's cool. I'm single. I've been single a long time. That's okay. I don't have a ton in my bank account. That's okay. I was out of work 3 out of 6 years. And you know what I experienced? Love and support. Whether it was a guy in the program that owned a diner that ran me a tab that I was actually going to pay back and did pay back when I started working again because he knew that I needed to have meals. And he let me eat there whenever I wanted to. And they just put it in the bottom of the register. I have men in my life because I do, with my spirituality, I go outside of the rooms as well to grow it. I have men in my life that when I couldn't make my rent, checks rolled into my house. And the only reason they did that was because they saw the path I was on and they saw the way that I treated people when I had money. I wasn't frivolous trying to be a big shot with it, but I was helpful with it. And I did the right things with it because there's a huge difference and it's about motives. What are your motives when you're doing that? The job I have today, I work at a cemetery. I get to care for people. I love it. I had said no to two people that asked me that years ago because I thought it was a little weird, a little bizarre. The person that asked me was through a referral through somebody in the rooms. They were looking to build a team. And they said, he's got a lot of sales experience. He'd be a good addition. And I took the job, and it was stressful for a few weeks because I started recently. But then it started to click. And all it was is me taking care of people. And I've gotten to help affect people's lives in a spiritual nature by making sure they feel whole with their family members, knowing where they're going to be at rest, and even through hard times. And I could only do it through Alcoholics Anonymous. My children, communicate with me today. Is it the relationship that I hope it will be someday? Probably not. But do you blame them? No, I don't blame them. All I do is love them. My daughter was up in the area. She had something happen. She called me at 10 o'clock at night, and I scooped her up. And she apologized, and I said, what are you apologizing for? Well, I didn't know what you're doing. I was sitting on my couch waiting for you to call. You know? She's 26. My son's 23. I saw him graduate college, play 4 years of football. These things happened because a guy in the rooms looked at his video from high school and said, with his size and his ability, you should look here. This is where he'll get a shot. My youngest, very close to her mom, as she should be. She was so young when I left, you know? That's got to be hard. You know, I know what it was like for me with my dad. I'm still not over some things, you know? Things can still get to me. I remember being 12 years old, crying at the corner when the father-son game was going on and my dad didn't show. I remember that stuff, right? So what happens now is my schedule's a little different. I've been having lunch with two of the three kids because the other one's working. Every Wednesday, we kind of have a standing lunch now. It's just started over the last few weeks. In the town that I created a lot of damage with, we get to go and we have breakfast for lunch. And right now, it's the three of us. And I hope that it's the four of us at some point if it's going to work out that way. But I'm really grateful for that. And on top of it, I listen to a lot of spiritual stuff with an hour and a half commute each way. And I heard a message where they talked about somebody doing service at a church, sharpening the pencils so that people could fill out the prayer requests that they needed and the connect cards. And my kids said they'd be up for doing that at the local church where I went to that the day after I went to my first meeting. And the pastor says, we would love that. That's awesome. And we're not going to make a big deal about it. But we're just going to go in there and we're going to make sure that it's ready because there's people that are hurting all over this world, both in the rooms and outside of the rooms. And when that kind of stuff happens, it's amazing. This morning, I had to go to the Jersey Shore, so I was up at 5 a.m. I was heading up to the Jersey Shore at 5:30 to drop my car off, which is another story. I got my car totaled on the PA Turnpike. No comment on the drivers. And my 87-year-old stepfather was in the back seat, buckled in, back in December, leaving my son's graduation. And he was asleep and buckled in. Thank God. Because we got hit real hard and it totaled my car. And it cost me, because I didn't have money to get into another car, and I had somebody that helped me out with that too. Because he knew that I'm sober and trying to do my best that I can to be of service to others. And I owe that all to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because if you guys were like me, you would kind of like reach out for help at the very last minute when you felt like crap and you have to stew in it for a while and then all of a sudden you scream out for help and then people swoop in and they help you and then you go do it again. And today, I don't have to do that same thing. That man lost his job and I've been staying in touch with him, just checking in on him. How's it going? How's it going? You know, and he just landed something really, really good for him and his family. So I'm looking at the time. We've got about 10 minutes left, and I'm not going to just keep going on and on. The bottom line is my thinking is different today. My actions and reactions still are not perfect. I used to hear people get up in front and say, well, I'm not perfect. And I was like, whatever. Like, I want to be white as snow and be amazing. Like, that's what I wanted. It was all or nothing for me with everything. And I kept coming around. I have good sponsorship. I love that there's bikers here because my other home group's in Jersey, the Allentown Men's Meeting. And it's full of bikers who hit their knees and pray. And when a new guy's doing his third step, we go up to the chapel. And about 10 or 12 of us, or whoever comes up, we say that third step prayer together. And it's powerful. And it's fellowship. And it's bringing a God of our understanding into our lives. So, for somebody that didn't have a higher power or God in his life, I truly believe this, and it's things that I've heard. Most of the stuff I didn't make up at all. God loves us. He wants us to be happy. That doesn't mean everything is going to be okay and amazing. Smooth sailing, I mean. And God's known you since you were born. And when I hear that, I say to myself, wow, like that's some love. Like, that's some love, and it was just my perspective that that couldn't be true that led me down a path of destruction and everything else around it. And today, I could actually bring that message, and it's okay if you struggle with whatever concept you have. Just look around. Just know that there's other people that are finding it, and use those rooms. Be open-minded. Don't close one box off. Leave them all open and find your way. I talked about the big picture, and I'll end on this. I've talked about the big picture before. Is we put up the big picture, you know, I'm going to stop biting my nails, I'm going to stop doing this, I'm going to stop doing that, I'm going to stop drinking, I'm going to lose weight. And then one would fall, they all fall, right? Hopefully some people can relate to that. Because, like, if I do one, they're all off. So I was talking to somebody, and I said, you know, you can think about the big picture all you want, and you can make those plans, and you're going to fall short every time. But one day at a time, you can paint your masterpiece. Because you're not looking at the big picture. You're looking at what's right in front of you. So I appreciate you guys coming out. I'm going to end it a little bit early, and thanks for having me.